Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Vote for Trump! Donald Trump!
Donald Trump!
And hell with the rest, he'll get us over the hump.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. And don't worry, we're not going to interview the flaming orange hair or anybody who supports him. But we are going to talk about elections and voter suppression. And in a moment, I'll be joined by Ari Berman, a senior contributing writer at The Nation, also publishes in Rolling Stone. And last year, he put out a book called Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And we're going to talk about how federal courts have ruled that there was intentional surgical precision employed in laws designed to keep people from voting. Before we get started, I want to thank the people who vote with their dollars to support the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Cynthia Von Hendricks, Abby McMillan, Natalie Reel, and Cheryl Fleming. Thank you, ladies. I very much appreciate your support. And if you're not a subscriber, it's never too late. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, then pull it down and click on Become a Subscriber. At the sign-up page, you can choose level of your support. And if you take out the $50 annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., you can choose from one of two bonus books. They're displayed on the sign-up page right now. And this beautiful country song called Vote for Trump, I found it on Spotify. It's by Rodney Carrington.
First things first, we all gotta vote for Trump.
Joining me for the NewsBud interview is Ari Berman. He's a senior contributing writer at The Nation, also publishes in Rolling Stone. And his latest book, out about a year now, is Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And voting rights are at center stage in this very tumultuous election cycle, Ari. Why is it getting harder to vote in the United States?
Well, good to be back with you, Peter B. So it's getting harder to vote because there have been a slew of laws passed in recent years to make it harder to vote. That first beginning after the 2010 election, when Republicans gained large legislative majorities across the country, half the states in the country passed laws making it harder to vote. Things not only like voter ID laws, but cutting back early voting, making it harder to register to vote, purging the voting rolls, disenfranchising ex-felons. We saw all of these efforts really escalate following the 2010 election. And then in 2013, when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, many of these laws that were blocked were allowed to go into effect, and then states passed new restrictions. And that's why all of this is coming to a head in 2016.
So we have a whole suite of voter suppression tactics, but those who embrace them all say that this is just to make our elections honest and to improve their integrity. That's a big fat lie, isn't it?
Yeah, there was no evidence of widespread voter fraud before all of these laws were passed. And in fact, there's no evidence that these laws have blocked fraud from occurring, because voter fraud is a very small problem in American elections. There's lots of hyperbole about it, but when you look at the facts, it's very rare. And voter impersonation in particular, so the kind of thing where Donald Trump says someone's going to show up and vote 10, 15 times in person, that is exceedingly rare. That since the 2000 election, there have been a billion votes cast and only 31 cases of voter impersonation. So it's just a really stupid, inefficient way to steal an election. If you try to do it, you're going to get caught.
You note in your book that as it applies to Florida, one is more likely to get bitten by a shark than experience, voter level fraud.
Not only are you more likely to be attacked by a shark than commit voter fraud, you're also more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to impersonate another voter. There are about 300 deaths and injuries by lightning each year, compared to only 31 cases of voter impersonation since 2000.
Yeah. Now, in a dramatic appeals court decision, the North Carolina law requiring a photo ID to vote was overturned, and the judge who wrote the opinion said that the provisions deliberately target African Americans, quote, with almost surgical precision. So this is calling out the obvious intention behind these laws.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that the North Carolina law was well beyond voter ID, that a month after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, North Carolina not only required strict ID to cast a ballot, but they cut back on early voting, they eliminated same-day voter registration, they eliminated out-of-precinct voting, they eliminated pre-registration for 16- and 17-year-olds, they even eliminated Citizens Awareness Month, which the state ran to encourage people to register to vote. All of this was in one bill. And so what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said, a unanimous panel of three judges, was that this law was passed to try to disenfranchise black voters. And as you've mentioned, they were targeted with, quote, almost surgical precision, that the law wasn't about stopping voter fraud, because there was very little voter fraud in North Carolina. The law was instead about trying to disenfranchise people of color who tend to vote Democratic.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at this, these court decisions are overturning these systematic efforts to block people from voting. And see if you can confirm this for me, Ari. One activist in North Carolina told me that in 2012, Democrats had roughly a 300,000 advantage in registrations, and that these tactics are designed to neutralize that and effectively level the playing field in an unjust manner.
Well, I think the big picture here is that for a long time, there were big gaps between black and white voters in North Carolina. And what happened is the state adopted a number of reforms beginning in 2000 to try to increase participation for everybody, things like early voting and same-day registration. That had a particularly beneficial effect on historically disenfranchised African-American voters. And so what we saw in 2008 and 2012, when North Carolina became a swing state, when Barack Obama was on the ballot, that black turnout actually exceeded white turnout for the first time in North Carolina history. And that really freaked a lot of Republicans in North Carolina out. And they were very, very worried that with the demographic change in that state, that would become the new normal. And so they targeted the very methods that African Americans and others had used to increase political participation. And that's what the Fourth Circuit said very clearly, that it was a response to the progress in North Carolina that Republicans were trying to cut back on.
Mm-hmm. So now that these Republican suppression tactics, in some cases, are going to be invalidated before the election, Donald Trump is warning that it will be rigged by, as you alluded to, people voting 10 or 15 times. This is ludicrous, but it also creates a basis to save face if he loses, and it also could produce a reaction from his supporters.
Yeah, well, there's a few different problems with what he's saying. The first is that, as you mentioned, he's trying to delegitimize the election before it's even occurred, which could have consequences after the election. The second thing is, now that he's calling for, quote, Trump election observers to, in his words, stop crooked Hillary from rigging the election, he is also creating a culture of intimidation and racial profiling, in my view, at the polls, which I think could be very, very toxic, because we have evidence that Trump's base are white conservative Republicans that are motivated by racial animus, that they are people that, for example, are motivated by dislike of African Americans, of Latinos, of Muslims. That's reflected in some of Trump's policy positions. So if Trump is trying to then have his supporters block legitimate voters from the polls, at the polls, that is a recipe for disaster. So I don't think we can just write off his rigged election comments. I think it's very important first to debunk them, but then also to say we have to be very, very vigilant. Even as he's going down in the polls, his campaign still has the capacity to wreak a lot of havoc.
Now, experts at Princeton keep warning us that the potential for hacking and manipulating election results is a serious problem. And with touchscreen voting machines that are 15 years or older, that never had great security features to begin with, and with the, in some cases, ability to hack into tabulation systems, what is your level of concern about the integrity of the mechanics of our electoral process?
I think it's concerning. Number one, as you mentioned, the machines are old, and they were supposed to be replaced within 10 years, and 10 years are up because these machines were purchased after the 2000 election. The second thing is there are still states, about 14 states, that don't have a paper trail, which is also concerning. And the third thing is just we've seen a lot of hacks already. I mean, regardless of what you think of the DNC, I mean, the fact that they were hacked is a little concerning, and I think given who some of Trump's associates are, I think that there is the possibility for foul play here. So I think that we need to be very concerned about our election security, especially when there's this whole culture around rigging the election, and one side in particular seems to be trying to gain an advantage here.
Now, Ari, in the Democratic primaries, there have been several studies published that raise important questions about the gap between the official tally and the unadjusted exit polls. Do you put any credence into these studies, and do you feel that voters were denied the opportunity to vote because their registration was changed without their knowledge? We know about the long lines in both Brooklyn and in Phoenix. So do you feel that the Democratic primaries were conducted fairly?
So this is my feeling on the Democratic primaries, and I know there are very strong feelings about this. I was neutral throughout the primary. I had reported on both sides and was on good terms with both sides. I think there were definitely voting problems in the primaries in places like Arizona, as you mentioned, where there are very long lines, in places like Brooklyn, where there were voter purges. But I don't believe there was a deliberate attempt by the Clinton campaign to disenfranchise Sanders supporters. And I say this because many Hillary supporters were the ones most impacted by some of this stuff. If you look at who was purged from the voting rolls in Brooklyn, they were more likely to be Black and Latino voters who supported Hillary. If you look at the long lines in Arizona, there were many voters of color that supported Hillary. So my position has always been that the bigger threat to, in terms of voter suppression, have been Republican efforts to try to disenfranchise Democrats. And it's not like the Republicans are saying, we want to disenfranchise Bernie supporters, but not Hillary supporters. They're trying to disenfranchise Democrats broadly. So that's where I think the focus should be, not on Sanders supporters blaming Clinton supporters or vice versa for voter suppression, because I don't think that's what went on during the primary.
A few weeks back, the New York Times published a graphic piece, and the conclusion was that when you boil it down, only 14% of eligible American adults, and what that boils down to even further is that only 9% of the entire nation voted for either Trump or Clinton. So is our democratic system a charade?
Well, I think that that's probably true for lots of different primaries. I mean, the fact is a lot of Americans don't vote in primaries, and that's because they either don't align with a party or, in fact, it's made difficult to vote. In some states, like in New York, you had to register with the party 6 months before the election, which many people weren't able to do, and that was a closed primary. So I would like to see us open up the primary process so more people can participate. It's also important to remember that a quarter of Americans aren't even registered to vote. So 60 million Americans aren't even going to participate in the presidential race. So we're already starting at 75% who are can possibly participate, and then we just go down from there. And that's why I'd love to see more states do what Oregon is doing right now, where you go to the DMV and you're automatically registered to vote in that state. It's coming to California next year, and I think that's the way to go to try to get a lot more people involved. First, they need to get registered, and then you can focus on getting them out to vote. But let's at least make sure that we can register 80 to 90% of Americans.
Ari Berman writes for The Nation, and his latest book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Now, Ari, when we look at the long arc of voting rights, and your book takes us back more than 50 years to the Civil Rights Movement and to the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Law, Give us your sense of the ups and downs over the past 50 years. And it appears we've entered a new period where voting rights are under assault, and something that we consider to be a fundamental right that, you know, should be automatic is something that many people have to overcome huge obstacles to exercise.
Yeah, well, that's really a theme throughout American history, that really what should be the most fundamental right, the right to vote, has been historically very, very contested. And the Voting Rights Act was supposed to end the debate about voting rights once and for all by bringing millions of new people into the political process and getting rid of all the voter suppression tactics that disenfranchised people. And it was remarkably successful. But as I show in my book, there has been a 50-year effort to try to roll back the Voting Rights Act that people like John Roberts, who started his career as a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department opposed to the Voting Rights Act, have been tremendously influential in rolling the Voting Rights Act and similar pieces of legislation back. And that often it's moments of the greatest progress that are followed by moments of the greatest backlash. And I think that's something that occurred after 2008. The election of the first black president led to all of these new efforts to make it harder to vote.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned Chief Justice Roberts. First, I want to acknowledge that this was an 8-1 decision in the Shelby case that overturned the most important element of the voting rights law. And you published...
No, it was a 5-4 decision.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misread that.
It was a 5-4 decision.
Okay. Well, I take that back, and thanks for correcting me. But at any rate, in the oral arguments, you published some quotes from the exchanges between the Chief Justice and the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli. And in it, Roberts is arguing that we just don't need this, that you know, there aren't any problems anymore. And he appears to be making the case that we have no racial conflicts or disparities in this country remaining today. And that is a pretty outlandish set of views held by our most important jurist.
Well, Roberts basically had a narrative in his stuff to it, which is that the country had made a tremendous amount of progress since 1965, but that the Voting Rights Act continued to treat the country as if nothing had changed. And in fact, what advocates of the Voting Rights Act said was that, of course, a lot of progress has been made since 1965. A lot of that progress is because of the Voting Rights Act. But there are still efforts to challenge people at the ballot box. There are still voter suppression efforts going on today. And so Roberts painted a very rosy picture of American society and really of the problem of race, which he viewed as negligible. Then you just look at what's happened since that decision. Not only the wave of new voter suppression efforts, but obviously police shootings, lots of different evidence of systemic racism that really seems to challenge Justice Roberts' idea that voting discrimination and other types of discrimination are a thing of the past.
And Ari, in your book, you help us understand how this kind of recent pushback has occurred. In 2011 and 2012, there were 180 new voting restrictions introduced in 41 states. 27 new laws took effect in 19 states, and almost all of those are controlled by Republicans. And you note the influence of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Of the 62 voter ID bills introduced in 37 states in 11 and 12, more than half were sponsored by ALEC, and the bills are almost carbon copies of each other. How does this type of legislation and the pattern of this behavior support the notion that this is an orchestrated effort by Republicans to reduce voter participation by groups who largely vote Democratic?
Well, that's exactly what it was. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is a group that pairs corporations with state legislatures. They're very influential. And basically, after the Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID law in 2008, ALEC drafted mock voter ID legislation that was then introduced in all of these states following the 2010 election in virtually identical form, whether it was Texas or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, the bills all look the same. And you don't just suddenly get a situation where 180 new voting restrictions are introduced in 41 states. Someone has to be organizing it. And it was certainly true that this was the strategy that the Republican Party decided to adopt after Barack Obama's election. And instead of trying to reach out to new constituencies, they wanted to instead make it harder for these new constituencies to be able to participate in the political process. And so this was not something that was a grassroots uprising. This was orchestrated at the highest levels of the Republican Party, and certainly an effort that was national in scope and very well organized.
And Ari, this acts on the commentary that came from Paul Weyrich, a longtime Republican political guru going back to the Reagan years. And he made a comment to the effect that, well, you know, we don't really want to see, additional voting. We benefit when fewer people turn out at the polls.
Yeah, and I think the parties right now just have different theories of the case. I think that Democrats believe they do better when there's a higher turnout, and that was certainly true in 2008 and in 2012. And I think Republicans believe they do better when there's lower turnout, and that was certainly true in 2010 and 2014. So the Democratic Party relies on lots of people who don't vote in midterms, who do vote in presidential elections, and they need high turnout. Republicans, however, have people who are more reliable voters, who are more affluent, who are older, and they believe that they're just fine when the electorate is smaller. And so when there were 5 million new voters in 2008 and they voted 75% for President Obama, that was something that was viewed as very bad for the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier the efforts by Donald Trump to set up poll watchers and to use a kind of intimidation tactic that is part of the Republican playbook going back and has been, demonized and penalized in the courts several times over the years. Describe this process of how they'll send postcards out to registered voters, and then depending on what the response is, they might try to purge them or challenge them if they vote.
Yeah, so they'll take these really unreliable lists of voters and they'll mail them to predominantly Black and Latino precincts. And then when the mail is returned as undeliverable because the lists were bad in the first place, they will then say that all of these voters need to be challenged at the polls. They did this in New Jersey in the 1980s, and they not only did that, but they actually hired off-duty cops to patrol the polling places, and they wore armbands that said National Ballot Security Task Force, and they carried weapons. And as a result of that, the DNC sued the RNC. And the RNC was told to refrain from any sort of ballot security initiatives. And subsequently, the RNC has tried to do this multiple times in places like Ohio in 2004, where they tried to purge thousands of Black voters for the rolls. And the DNC has sued and successfully blocked the RNC. So when Trump said that people are voting fraudulently in certain parts of Pennsylvania, everyone knew which parts of the state he was talking about. He was talking about places like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and he was talking about people like African Americans and Latinos voting. And then he said, we need law enforcement to stop this. First off, that violated Pennsylvania law. Law enforcement officials can't be at polling places to intimidate voters under Pennsylvania law or really any state or federal law. But not only that, it was the very kind of thing courts have said the RNC can't do.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, this just kind of adds to the list of commentary from Trump that is so at odds with reality and his ignorance of the details of the electoral process surface here. And even Karl Rove acknowledged that in comments quoted in the New York Times over the weekend about the disarray inside the Trump campaign. Rove, the so-called Bush's brain, he met with Trump, I guess, in May and came away pretty shaken that this guy really doesn't understand the nuts and bolts of how an election works.
Well, and I kind of predicted this would happen because I knew that as Trump's poll numbers went down, that as he was getting 0% of the Black vote, for example, in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio, he would become more desperate. And we'd hear more arguments about rigged elections and people voting 10 times and people voting fraudulently in certain parts of the state, in certain parts of the country. And this is what people do when they're losing. They try to make excuses for it. And And Trump is someone who's both incredibly desperate and incredibly hyperbolic. And so I think you can just laugh it off, but I view it as far more dangerous. I think there's a real possibility of lots of intimidation, possibly violence. I don't even know at the polls. So I'm taking this very seriously.
Ari, what is your, if you gave a letter grade to the Obama Holder Justice Department, and in particular its voting rights division, would you say that they addressed these challenges properly and in an expedient and timely manner? Or do you feel that they, you know, just kind of let it happen and threw up some cases to see what the courts would say?
Well, I'd probably give them a B. In the sense that I think that they were caught off guard, like everybody was, by all of these new voting restrictions that happened after the 2010 election. I think a lot of people felt like high political participation was here to stay following Obama's election, not that there would be attempts to try to restrict the right to vote. And then you had the Supreme Court that was clearly hostile towards the Voting Rights Act, so they had to prepare for that law to be gutted. They did sue states like Texas and South Carolina and Florida during the 2012 election, so I think they did what they could, but I think it was a difficult situation to be in. I mean, you had all of these states passing new voting restrictions. You had a Supreme Court signaling that they were going to gut the Voting Rights Act, which they later did. And this is just difficult to stop. We have very different dynamics now than we had in 1965 when the Voting Rights Act was passed. Remember, we had huge majorities, both Democrat and Republican, in favor of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. We don't have that anymore. The Republican Party doesn't support the Voting Rights Act anymore. We had the Earl Warren Court, totally different court than the Roberts Court. So the political dynamics have made it much harder for the Obama Justice Department or any Justice Department right now to try to protect voting rights.
And going forward, I think you kind of answered my next question, but given the gerrymandering of the House, it is hard to imagine a shift in the attitudes of the majority Republicans that would permit the reinstatement of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act or something parallel to it.
Well, when Republicans won huge majorities in the 2010 election, they didn't just win one election, they won a decade's worth of elections because they got to draw all of the lines after the U.S. Census came out. And that allowed them to completely manipulate states like Pennsylvania that would otherwise be blue. To just give you one example, Barack Obama carried Pennsylvania twice by comfortable margins, but Republicans control 13 of 18 congressional districts in Pennsylvania. And so lots of Republicans there are just worried about their latest primary challenge as opposed to any sort of competitive race. And so there's very, very few moderate Republicans left. There's lots of conservative Republicans that don't even face competitive races. And the problem of gerrymandering has completely warped the political system and has really emboldened Republicans to pass these new voting restrictions to do nothing about restoring the Voting Rights Act. And so I always say that I don't think you can really do anything about voting rights without both addressing the problem of gerrymandering and also addressing the problem of the incredible amount of money that warps the political process.
Mm-hmm. And we have seen courts nibble away at gerrymandering in a handful of states. But we're not seeing any concerted effort that would really clean up the process. And to be fair, when they had majorities, Democrats used the power to gerrymander as Republicans are today.
Yeah.
But it is extremely egregious, at least to me, in the current way that it's being used. And, you know, we have one of the few legacies of Arnold Schwarzenegger was that with Common Cause, he helped pass a ballot measure that created a Citizens Redistricting Commission. And so in California, we do have not those really weird, you know, jigsaw puzzle lines that other states have, but we have a coherent system of assigning districts. And I'm really proud of that. And I helped support it at the time when my Democratic friends were saying, oh, no, that's going to hurt Democrats. It's actually helped Democrats. But that's not the point to me. It is a fair and transparent process, unlike too many of the other states.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't believe that politicians should draw their own districts. I don't think, I mean, you wouldn't hire yourself for a job interview unless maybe you were Dick Cheney. And so I think it's one of those situations where the unfortunate thing is that the Supreme Court has said that racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional, but they've never said that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. So Republicans or Democrats, whoever's in control, can just draw districts to benefit themselves, and there's really no consequences unless they run afoul of something like the Voting Rights Act. And I would like to see that clarified. I think either the court could clarify it, or the easiest way would be to try to take the drawing of districts out of the hands of the politicians themselves. I'm not Pollyannish to expect this will happen anytime soon, but I think that's the ultimate solution we should be moving to.
Yeah. Ari Berman, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for your new book, Give Us the Ballot. I think you've done a great job of showing the history and the new conflicts over voting rights in America.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Ari Berman. Your comments are welcome. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails.